Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine. Come in, microbiome, come in. It's Kitty Martone, healthy gut girl. And I am coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine. And never was it so exciting to be here in your large intestine as it is today, this moment, this hour, because today we have an incredible guest that is specializing in your microbiome. This is Dr. Shayna. And she's a neuroscientist with an interest in alternative medicine that utilizes the body's innate systems and a passion for medical education and scientific communication. She received her doctoral degree in neuroscience from the University of British Columbia and has been working in the field of medical affairs in non-traditional medicines for the last 3 years since leaving academia. She's currently the director of medical communications and affairs at Novel Biome, which provides, get this, listen up, high-quality medically supervised fecal microbiota transplants, FMTs, for children with autism spectrum disorder, ASD. Part of her role is to help spread education and scientific information about the microbiome and FMTs that is accessible, accurate, and digestible, wink, wink. This is a heavy hitter. You know how much I like to have these people on. She is, this is such a good episode, you guys. You know what it did? It brought me back to my roots once again, which is gut health. You know, I tend to veer off and I get in the weeds with thyroid and metabolic dysfunction and mineral balance. And you know, I have to remind myself that none of it matters if you are not digesting, if your digestion is not upregulated and you have gut issues. You have to address these issues. And a lot of people will say, well, how can you if you have mineral imbalance, or how can you if you are in a hypometabolic state? It's one of the most accessible first steps that we have that we're in control of, right? Is our digestion, is what we put into our bodies, how we digest it, and how we are passing the waste matter from that food that we're consuming, how effectively we're doing that. And then, you know, yeah, you can get caught up in the minutiae of thyroid and slow motility and hypometabolic states and mineral balance and all that stuff. Hormones, la la. But ultimately, we need to focus on the state of our guts. We have to. The health of our gut. And Dr. Shane is going to talk all about it. And she's wonderful. I want to say that this treatment is not available to Canadians. Okay, I just want to make that as a disclaimer right away. And I'll say it again at the end of this episode. But first of all, why don't you just take out a pencil? Do we do that anymore? Take out your iPhone and take a note and some notes and listen to what Dr. Shayna has to share with us. She is fantastic. Anyway, I'm super excited because I've been doing gut health for 17 years, just in my nutritional way that I do things and talking about it and having guests on my show for 7 years and, writing a couple cookbooks here and there about gut health and ways to remediate, you know, gut dysbiosis and upregulate healthy digestion and la, la, la. And I have kind of come away and started doing a lot of hormone work, but you know, you can't separate yourself from it. It always comes back to gut health, no matter what. Like when you have issues with your hormones and you're just dealing with all these imbalances, ultimately you're led right back to gut health, right? Yeah. By the way, we're going to go ahead and start recording. So
yeah, it's such an interconnected system. And I think that's where medicine is headed. Mm-hmm. I think we're starting to understand that each part of our body, each system is not standing independently. I have a neuroscience background. So I come from a field that is very like brain heavy. The brain does everything. Everything is the brain. The answer to all your questions is the brain. And in the last 10 years, that's started to shift. We're starting to understand that like the food you eat impacts your brain, your environment, the choices you're making, all of those are impacting your brain, but your brain is also impacting those systems. So we're starting to understand that it's more of a kind of cyclical or a joined kind of idea versus being independent. You know, your heart's not independent from your gut, but your gut's not independent from your brain. So I think we're moving that way. And I mean, you make a good point. You can't look at one system and it not lead you back to the gut. Yeah. And I think that's something that like, I'm really appreciating more every day. The more I learn about it, the more I'm seeing that like, it really is a driving force, but we don't appreciate what dysfunction of the gut can do. And part of that is because we don't know yet.
Yeah.
The number of things that like next week, I'm going to learn something else that's going to shift everything again, which is so exciting. But at the same time, it's like, we're at the beginning, we're at the beginning of understanding all this and we already know a lot. Mm-hmm. So it's very exciting. I love it. I can talk all day about it.
I know. I'm glad because I want you to. I really feel like, wondering how it happened. I'm curious about the science and what you know, or what you can tell us about how they started to recognize that it was the gut. Like, was there any specific study that was done that all of a sudden people went, oh, wait a minute. Because for me, on my own personal experience was just growing up really ill and being put on all these medications and having all kinds of problems. And then getting to the point in my life where I was just couldn't do the meds anymore and had to say, okay, I'm going to have to try to take this into my own hands and move to California where, you know, there's a Reiki master on every corner. And so started to go down that road. And my first thing was meeting my husband, who's a chiropractor, and him saying to me, he works with these children that have autism, and I can't wait to talk about that. We're going to be here all day, by the way.
I'm in, let's do it.
And him saying, you know, what we notice so much just in his chiropractic work and working with these children is like, you know, their guts, like they're all constipated. They all have candida. They all have, you know, massive, horrible bowel movements that are painful for them. And everything seems to come to the gut with these children. And so why isn't it that with us? Like, why isn't that the case with us? And you know, just being from that chiropractic world, they were already looking at some alternative things. And so my life shifted and I started to discover, okay, I need to start fixing my gut here. And it was foreign to me completely. So what happened in science? Was it just a collection of things where people started to pay attention to the gut?
Yeah. I can tell you the big one for me and things that kind of shifted, I'm not going to say for all people in neuroscience, but it was a big shift. Was the correlation between people with Parkinson's disease and 10 years before they're showing symptoms, the consistency and similarity of GI symptoms. And I think that was the start of kind of understanding that when we see a disease, that may not be when it starts, but it was also one of maybe there's something happening somewhere outside of where we have decided the disease is that could be the beginning or an indicator of. And so that was a big shift. I started my master's work ended up being looking at feeding hormones in the brain and how that could, you know, tie into some deterioration in memory centers. And so this kind of belief of like, hold on, wait, the gut is doing this, it's being driven by all of these factors, but these factors are elsewhere in our body. Mm-hmm. Or when these things shift, we see move shift, you know, like you eat terribly, you don't feel well, you continue to eat terribly, but your mood continues to decrease. So I was like, okay, are those things connected? And I think that's slowly been happening. And I think it's a shift of looking, we started looking very tiny in science in general. We got smaller and smaller. We wanted to know like what gene is changing, what molecule is changing. And I think we're starting to step outward again of like, okay, so like, but what does that mean? Where does that get us? And I think that's been the shift of like, okay, so like if we understand something really tiny, but what does that mean in terms of your whole health? How can we actually make a change? But I think that early kind of eye-opening of these disorders that we don't really have any fix for, but starting to look back further and going, was there something before this that could lead to it? And it's for a lot of them, it's gut changes. You were talking about with kids with autism spectrum disorder or autism, and they're 3 times more likely to have GI issues. And not only that, is their GI issues are more severe. And not only that, severity of GI symptoms correlate with their autistic behaviors. So this is clearly important. And I think we're seeing that in more disorders. We're seeing it in MS. We're seeing it in kind of understanding in cancer treatments, how hard that is on the body, but how hard that is on the gut. Should we be considering the gut as part of that repair process? And so it's kind of, we're looking more and more as things seem to boil down to our gut. And it's so much more connected than anyone can appreciate. It can affect your heart. It plays a role in bone density, but it also communicates with your brain and is creating its own neurotransmitters. So like it's doing way more. And that's where we're, what we know now, what we're going to know in 5 years from now is I think going to change everything all over again. But I think we're on the right path to kind of appreciating that it's important and starting to look at which disorders seem to have shifts in the gut or changes or gut dysbiosis or not neurotypical or not typical to the normal population. And that's what we're seeing. So you're seeing a lot of these studies in kids with ASD is comparing them to their neurotypical pairs. And we're seeing big things like those guts are underdeveloped. So they don't look where they are age-wise. And now we're appreciating, oh wait, the gut is tied to cognitive function in development. It has critical periods just like the brain does. If you don't meet those, systems don't get where they need to be. The immune system's not, you know, mature enough. So is it okay? So is it being delayed in not even neurodevelopmental disorders, but other disorders? And so that's where we're going, is trying to figure out when does the gut change so that it's not typical.
Wow. That's so interesting, because I never thought of that in terms of like, you know, when a child is born like early and their respiratory system is not like fully developed. It's not totally mature. And so that was my thing when I was born, like a month early, and then just right away had like pneumonia. And it's just because my lungs hadn't fully developed. And, but I hadn't thought in terms of, yeah, okay, like the brain doesn't fully develop or the kidneys don't fully develop, but the gut, that's so interesting. And I remember learning that and please correct me if I'm saying anything wrong, is that a baby's gut is sterile when it's born, and then it gathers all of its microbes through the vaginal canal or through a C-section less, but and then it takes about 3 months or so before that baby has its own mature microbe, well, not mature, but microbiome of its own. Is that close?
It's debated, which I'm probably going to say 100 times today, and I already apologize, but that is kind of where we're at in the science. The strong held belief is that the gut microbiome is sterile until birth. And so vaginal births kind of really set the gut microbiome and your microbiome in total. Your microbiome is everywhere, but we kind of focus in on the gut microbiome as a whole. But breastfeeding plays a big role in that. But also the gut doesn't really develop until kids are, you know, some studies are looking at 2-3 years old. It may be older than that. But we're not 100% sure it's sterile or if there is some development early happening. Always really difficult, of course, because like they're in a womb, hard to get in there and take a look around. But we're starting to appreciate that maybe something's happening earlier, or maybe there's some kind of building blocks that are there. But I mean, the wide held belief is that most of it's going to happen after birth. And that's why, I mean, the gut is kind of set up on part of its trajectory really early on, right from when you're born. And we know that the biggest shifts in the gut happen when you're, you know, just being born really young and when you're old. So the gut kind of plays in kind of the two biggest swings in our lifespan, shows huge changes, plays huge roles. And so there's kind of this appreciation of like what's happening in development, but also like what deterioration of the gut, how that might tie into deterioration of other parts of the body or other. So we have like neurodevelopmental disorders that are kind of growing and trying to understand that, but we're also looking at these other neurodegenerative diseases as well. On top of all of the other diseases that seem to kind of be coming up, and the list is long, but it's kind of ranges from, you know, something neurodevelopmental like ASD or autism spectrum disorder, but also into, we're seeing new ones in neurodegenerative disorders like Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, as well as Alzheimer's disease. We're seeing more popularity and kind of excitement in that study, but it's all really new. We're kind of just coming out of like preclinical or in the kind of the lab base, going now into more clinical studies, and the number of clinical studies are growing kind of at a rapid pace of trying to understand, okay, so like, what does the gut look like and does changing the gut do something? And I think that's super
Wow. I mean, I have this sort of like microcosm of what it must be like to be in the science world, because just in my own practice and in my Facebook group and my podcast and everything, I'm like getting, okay, it's a metabolic issue, it's a hormonal issue, it's a gut issue, it's a da-da-da-da-da. And you're like chasing around what you think could be the source of whatever imbalance you might be looking at. And I can't even begin to imagine having access to all the data and all the resources and everything and all the different people doing all the different studies, and just feel like it's growing so fast. I mean, you mentioned earlier, like, and you said you'll say it a bunch, is how much it's changing. And I remember thinking when I first started working with Donna Gates, and she's the author of The Body Ecology Diet, and she works with autistic kids, the same kind of concept as the GAPS diet with Natasha McBride, who wrote Gut and Psychology Syndrome back in, you know, the pioneer who did all that. And her telling me, you know, she wasn't really big at the time on recommending probiotics. And she's like, we don't really know what's happening with the probiotics. Like, we're not sure if it's colonizing or if it's inoculating, or we don't even know if it's getting past the stomach acid, really. And so I was real hesitant when I went off on my own after working with her to recommend probiotics, because it made me nervous, because I thought, what could possibly be happening? Could those bacteria, if they're doing anything, be getting stuck, you know? And then all of a sudden we see this huge problem with SIBO. Can you speak a little bit on that in regards to like probiotics and how they really aren't doing what we thought they were meant to be doing? Is that right?
Yeah. Probiotics are a slippery slope when it comes to the science. There are studies out there that show changes. There are studies that show they don't make any changes. I think there's so many strains of bacteria. There is no probiotic that this is the best bacteria. Mm. We can't even say that about like what makes a healthy gut microbiome. We do not have a definition for that. We don't have a definition for what dysbiosis is in the gut. Every disorder looks different. The gut microbiome changes so much. You can change your diet today and in 24 hours, your gut will shift.
Wow.
And so it's constantly changing. I think the most important thing when it comes to probiotics is to understand that they're transient. So that means that while you're taking a probiotic, it is doing something. It can do something. It can be in the gut. We do see those bacteria there. Mm-hmm. But when you stop taking a probiotic, they're not engrafted. So when you're not taking a probiotic, you don't see it in the stool anymore. So from that indication, it seems like it's not staying in the gut. It's not becoming really part of the gut microbiome. So I think that's an important thing to say, that it does or doesn't do anything. We're not there in the science yet. There's some really nice clinical trials that I think should be coming out soon that are going to talk. I mean, from my expertise, that, you know, we're seeing more of those for ASD, and we're seeing more clinical trials. And I think that's what we need to do to get a fuller understanding of like, what does it mean when you are taking it, what is it actually doing? And what does it mean that it's not engrafting? What is, like, you know, are you going to have to take them forever? Or do they stop working over a long period of time? And those are questions that, you know, kind of aren't answered yet. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes in hand with still learning about what the gut is doing and why it's important. Because, okay, so like that bacteria is, you know, we know it does something and we know it's good, so let's add that in. Oh, but it's not actually shifting the gut. So what does that mean when, if you take someone else's gut microbiome that has that and it engrafts, it makes a change. Okay, so like, what's the difference? Why is the same bacteria doing different things in different scenarios? And we're just not there yet.
Yeah.
And that's, wow. It's exciting, but very difficult, because there aren't clear answers. We can't say these are the five bacteria you need and it will solve these five problems. Mm-hmm. But we do know diversity is important. And so it's what diversity, what does that diversity look like? And then I think as we define more and more what it looks like for each disorder and what it looks like across the ages, because we see differences, people that live to 100 have a different gut microbiome. And so, okay, well, why is that important? And so we're still learning about that, and we're still, you know, understanding how environmental changes. The society doesn't look like it did 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So do our guts look different, and is that a good thing or a bad thing? So, you know, there's a lot.
There's a lot of things, and it's interesting because, you know, from my perspective is trying to help people and some of these children, and you know, it's like I recommend something and I'm like, well, we don't know, just like you said. And so it's a little nerve-wracking to recommend something and not know, you know, exactly what's going to happen to that particular person, and hopes that, you know, we're just going to see some beneficial changes. What, just for my audience, because I haven't been talking about gut health in depth in probably quite a while. So just for new people, can you talk about what diversity is and like, what does that mean in a gut? Because some people, you know, don't really have a picture of what's going on in their gut and how they came about finding out that a diverse microbiome was a better microbiome. Like, what does that even mean?
So, that's a good question. Your gut microbiome is filled with bacteria, fungi, even viruses, but they're good and they're working together to improve health. And so we kind of call it gut health, but it seems to impact kind of your general health. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your gut protects against pathogens. So to help your gut, but it also plays a role in your immune system, and it plays a role in you know, gut-brain communication. So what's in your gut helps dictate kind of these signals or these communications or these connections. From what we understand is when a gut has a low diversity or only has a couple. So if you think about the gut has, you know, over 100 trillion bacteria in it. Mm. But if all of those were one type of bacteria, if it came up against something it never, you know, crossed before, something that, you know, you normally don't, you know, new environmental factor, a new food, but you only have 100 trillion of one kind of bacteria, you won't be able to process that food, or you won't be able to kind of, you know, build a defense against something you're coming new against. So the idea here is that having a bunch of different types that can, you know, interact with the environment or interact with the food that you eat, to best utilize those things and best prepare you for what you're going to come up against. So one good example is, you know, as we age, the diversity in our gut goes down, but we also look at, you know, how gut health changes, how health in general changes as you age. So it seems to those things kind of go together. So as you lose diversity in your gut, but you're also kind of losing some of the hallmarks of youth, I guess would be the word that I would choose there. So it's, while we don't know which bacteria, which viruses, which fungi you want in your gut to say that those ones are the ones that are the best, we know that having a wide variety allows kind of your gut to be prepared for, you know, whatever it's going to get thrown at based on, you know, what you're, where you're going to go next, the people you're going to meet, the food that you're going to encounter, because all of those things allow your body to kind of, you know, absorb the right nutrients, process the right fats, but as well as, you know, send the right signals out that like, hey, our immune system needs to go together. You know, inflammation is important right now. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have the right bacteria there, they're not going to send those signals out. So your body isn't going to be prepared when it's going to come up against, you know, any number of things, depending on, you know, if it's a Wednesday or Thursday.
Right. So what naturally makes a diverse microbiome? Like, I know they've done a lot of studies where they have seen that, you know, farmers and people that work the land and are on farms and have animals, they tend to have more diverse microbiomes. So is it exposure to obviously makes the most sense, but what makes a naturally, as opposed to like taking probiotics and taking a bunch of different types, because people will see that on a bottle, right? They'll say, ooh, this has this many types of strains and this billion, you know, probiotics, so I'll take this one. Instead of that, how are we naturally acquiring a diverse microbiome?
Yeah. There's a whole movement that, like, when you mentioned about like farmers having a different gut microbiome, or people living in kind of rural communities, their microbiomes looking different. There is a new I'm going to say new, but it's been around for a little while. The idea of societal changes or what you're encountering, this idea of rewilding or the wilding of the gut. So we're not at a point where we can say like, okay, so because you interact with this kind of dirt or these types of animals, your gut will be better. But we do know that as society has changed and we've started being inside more, interacting with less, being out in nature less, our guts have changed. And with that, we're also seeing changes in what disorders are coming up, what prevalence of different things we're seeing. So we can't say that like, because we're not in nature and not outside as much, then that means there are different disorders. But we do know that as society has changed and become more industrialized, there has been a shift in the gut microbiome. Mm-hmm. And with that, there's also been a shift in similar time course to what diseases there are. I think if people want to know, like, what do I do today to make a better gut microbiome, which I think is kind of the underlying of that's, we want to know, how do we get healthier? Mm-hmm. I think it's important to look at what we know has a negative impact on the gut. And what of those we can change? So we know the environment is important, but environmental toxins are really huge. They have really negative, they're like a hammer to the gut. They can kind of really negatively impact what's there and what survival you have. So things like pesticides, heavy metals, mold. So those, being aware of what's in your environment and what things you can improve and avoid are key. Mm-hmm. Your diet, things high in sugar, high in kind of, you know, high in sugar, low in fiber. Those aren't good for your gut. Mm-hmm. And so being aware of the fact that the foods that you eat are feeding what's in your gut and you want them there and you want them healthy. So being aware of what foods you're eating and how those can impact, you know, what's in your gut. Eating a diverse diet feeds a number of different bacteria and things in your gut. So the more diverse diet you have, the more, you know, diverse bacteria you're feeding. We always suggest is like, try to eat 50 different foods every week.
Oh, wow.
That's a lot. But, you know, if you eat a mixed greens pack, that's going to have, you know, 5 or 6 different types of greens. That's 5 or 6 different types of food. So while it sounds like a huge number, if you really sit down and look at what you're ingesting, you're eating a lot of different foods. But the more diverse that becomes, the more diverse, you know, gut you can feed. And I mean, things that we know are already bad for us, we appreciate are bad for the gut. Being really stressed, not sleeping well, smoking, excessive drinking, those things are bad for you as a whole, but they're also really bad for your gut microbiome. So being aware of things that negatively impact your overall health, which also negatively impact your gut, are really important to understand because, you know, those are changes you can make that help kind of restore the gut that you have.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So that brings me to diving deeper here with this concept of like, one of the big things that you work on and talk about is the FMTs and the fecal microbiota transplants, right?
Yes.
And so I had a woman on my show probably like 4 or 5 years ago who had ulcerative colitis and she was dying. She was literally dying. And she ended up going to London to the Tamount Clinic or to England to the Tamount Clinic there. And she had to have multiple visits there back and forth, but ultimately she was healed and cured of her issues through these FMTs. And I had tried to investigate it further and noticed that there weren't a lot of places. I think Florida at the time, there was a doctor or a hospital there that was doing it. And then I noticed that a lot of people were going rogue online and doing things themselves. And then I decided to do probiotic implants, right? To take like wheatgrass and Saccharomyces boulardii and just start doing these experiments with like rectal implants and do them on my husband. On my husband who had this ongoing issue with eczema and always had like stuffed up, like apnea kind of. And it was tremendous what happened, but we'll talk about that later. But so I want to know, like, it doesn't seem like it's available in the US as much as I thought it would be, even 4 years later or 5 years when I had that girl on. And I'm just curious where that science is. But first, tell us what it is, because a lot of people don't know what it is.
Yeah, so fecal microbiota transplantation, or FMT, is the process of taking a healthy donor's gut microbiome, so through their stool. And when I say a healthy gut donor, donors are heavily screened. So when we think about the gut microbiome, we keep talking about how widespread the effects are. Well, that's why they're so well screened. So not only a donor's health, but their family history of any disorder that we think could possibly be tied to the gut. So that ranges from cancers, neuropsychiatric diseases, obesity, any cardiovascular issues, any GI issues. If that's within the donor, but as well as within their family, they can't be a donor.
Wow.
And that's to ensure you're not going to transfer anything. So these bacteria play a big role, and we don't want to provide bacteria to somebody that could then trigger them to kind of develop some kind of disease or disorder. As well, their blood and stool is screened to ensure there's no, viral pathogens or there's no negative things in the stool or in the donor themselves that could be transferred.
Wow.
I think it's what ends up happening is in that first initial screening, when you look at their health, about between 50 and 80 people are right off the bat from just that health screening are not available to be donors.
Wow.
At Novel Biomes, the company that I work for, we actually have more stringent than what is kind of published or used regularly. So, in some cases, a donor can have used, antibiotics 3 months before they donate. At our company, you can have never used antibiotics in your life because antibiotics
Wow.
have a huge, huge impact on the gut microbiome. They can really wipe it out. We only have people that were vaginally born. We know that really sets up a good building block for the gut microbiome. So if we're going to give that to another person, we want to ensure everything that can be controlled to create a good microbiome is.
Wow. Is there an
So
age range?
there's no set. Younger gut microbiomes are really good. As you get older, we know it deteriorates. So, I mean, for most people, we don't, like, if you look at the published standards, it's normally under 60. For us, we don't use right now, we don't have anyone under the age of 30, to ensure that it's kind of the gut in its prime. You want to, if you are going to distill this, you're going to purify it, which is kind of the next step. You get a screened donor, you take their stool and you purify it. You get it down to the bacteria that are going to play a big role in kind of recolonizing someone's gut. You want to ensure that what we have there is going to create a healthy gut microbiome, because what we're doing is you're taking donor stool, purifying it, getting it down to the bacteria that we want. And then somebody that has a dysfunctional gut is going to have that kind of engrafted in their gut. And that's through, I mean, currently a lot of them are done through colonoscopy, and oral capsules are becoming really popular. And we're seeing that there's no difference between the outcomes. When we think about C. diff, there's no real difference between outcomes for capsules versus colonoscopy, which is really, it's a huge shift because it costs less to do capsules, but it's also a lot more comfortable and it has a reduced risk compared to having a colonoscopy.
So when you do the colonoscopy, is it because it has to get to a certain place in the colon and that's why you do it that way? Why can't it just be inserted like a suppository?
Yeah. So the gold standard has been colonoscopy, and that's because most of the studies and work have been done in colonoscopy.
Okay.
The methods kind of range. So there's upper GI routes, like nasogastric tube, but there's also a number of lower ones. So colonoscopy and retention enema are both used.
Okay.
But colonoscopy's become kind of the gold standard. That's the one that's been used most regularly. The creation of FMT capsules has only happened in the last couple of years. And this allows kind of the understanding of that fresh stool, which it was used originally, doesn't have, we don't think, any better impact than frozen stool. And by being able to use frozen stool means you can screen donors ahead of time. You can create capsules that are partially freeze-dried so they can be shipped. And that allows not every hospital, not every center has to be able to prepare and screen donors for FMT. You can now get
Okay.
it from kind of stool banks or specialized centers. So,
Okay.
with the creation of all of these things, I think that's going to lead to kind of more acceptance and use of FMT. But we're really at the beginning. So The idea is someone gets FMT in one of these ways. There's a large number of them. But for us, we provide retention enemas at one of our centers. We have oral capsules and we have an oral powder as well, because we're working with kids a lot. The oral powder can be mixed with water or juice. And so with kids that can't swallow capsules can take an oral powder. And then what happens is that those bacteria get into the gut and they re-educate the gut. They're going to teach the gut what bacteria should be here, how do we function the best. And that's kind of how we kind of simplify what happens with FMT is you put the bacteria in there and it teaches the gut what bacteria should be there, and grafts into the gut so they stay there, but they also help kind of build that community over time. We know that FMT's kind of use right now is as you were saying, in the last 4 years, it hasn't really grown, and it hasn't to the level within the US or within Canada. It's really focused right now on treating C. diff, or which is kind of, we're finding it in hospitals. People kind of go into the hospital, they get this bacterial infection, and a lot of it is, it seems to be tied to the use of antibiotics, where antibiotics kind of wipe out the bacteria in the gut. And this kind of bad or negative bacteria grows to a large number. And we see, you know, it leads to a lot of GI issues and a lot of diarrhea. People lose a lot of weight, and is one of the more leading causes of death. And we're seeing it outside of hospitals, and we're seeing it in large numbers in hospitals. And so currently the first line of treatment for that is more antibiotics. But when antibiotics doesn't work, what's been, what's currently approved for FMT is just for in those cases, for people that have C. diff, antibiotics doesn't work to get rid of it, they get FMT. We know that FMT works 90% of the time in these cases.
Wow.
So it works really well. And things are just starting to build now. So there was just recently the FDA approved a pharma company for their FMT for C. diff. And while we've been using FMT for C. diff for a while, this approval means that, okay, that's the first step to seeing FMT for anything else. It's just, you have to, it's the beginning of kind of the acceptance, because it's a natural based, it's not, you know, a synthetic. It's, you know, what standards do we need? What are the standards for manufacturing? How do we make sure it is consistent and safe? And I think we're getting there now as more standards have been put in place and a better understanding of, you know, how kind of entrenched our gut is into different disorders. So what are we screening for? What's important for a donor not to have? We're just starting to really, I think, appreciate fully.
Wow. I think I've said wow like 100 times already today in this podcast. I might have misspoken. I think the girl that I had on did have C. diff, and I said ulcerative colitis, right? I think she had C. diff. But do you see this being used? Do you think it's headed in this direction where it's, it makes sense to me? I mean, yes, C. diff for sure, maybe ulcerative colitis, but just almost anyone who's got really severe gut dysbiosis. I mean, in my Facebook group, we have 22,000 women in there now with, it's called the estrogen dominant support group. And you can imagine how many of us are in there complaining about things. And, you know, there's so much like malabsorption and so much SIBO. And I mean, it's just so rampant. And also anxiety disorders and depression and, you know, suicidal ideation and all of that stuff. And I'm like, gosh, I crossed my mind before where it's like, I could see this just being a cure for a lot of things where you just, you know, do you see it that being that way? Or it would take an awful long time to where it's like prescribed by a doctor for just about any gut related disorder?
Yeah, I think we're getting to the point where we're appreciating its abilities. I think the growth in clinical trials in the last 5-10 years, going from having like 30 to 300, is huge. Wow. The number of diseases that is being looked at are really important. And we're starting to see that it plays a role, but it's not so clear cut because it won't work for everything and it won't work for everybody. So how do we screen for that? And, you know, we're talking about GI based issues. If you're talking about things like, you know, irritable bowel syndrome or irritable bowel disease, that has an inflammatory process within it. So you have inflamed states and non-inflamed states. Okay, so does treating in a non-inflamed versus an inflamed state, do you get the same outcomes? And so that's the nitty-gritty we have to understand before it can be applied to different things is that, okay, so like what, when does it work best? What states does it have to be in for really to see changes? I think there are some areas where the current research that's there, and I think the research that's coming is astounding. One of those areas is with children with ASD. And I think we're going to see more and more, even in Parkinson's disease, there's a handful of clinical trials that are happening right now that I think are really well laid out. And the initial work that's been done, not only do we see GI improvements, but we see improvements in, you know, outward based Parkinson's behaviors or in ASD, changes in ASD behaviors. So we're like, okay, so the gut change seems to lead to other changes. Okay, so like, how do we understand that and see that consistently? And I think that's where we're at now. It's like, okay, let's do the work. Let's get a better understanding. Let's see what the outcomes are, how consistent they are. Okay, then where can we apply them? There's more buy-in from larger pharma companies, which I think is really important because clinical trials aren't cheap. And the number of disorders that have been linked to gut dysfunction is long. So how do, you know, how do we best tackle that? And I think as we get more buy-in from kind of larger pharma and, you know, society as a larger pact, it's like, okay, so like, this is important. And while I think one of the holdups with FMT has been that it does require stool transfer. While it's purified and it's not, you know, it's not what you would consider, you know, stool, it's, that's where it is at its base. And that's something that people, and I think in general, we have to get past. And I think that's where we're headed. I think people are appreciating that their gut is important. And with that are appreciating that, you know, these bacteria are important and that, you know, being able to transfer healthy bacteria to someone that doesn't have them has huge impacts. And I think that's where we're going. And I think that that understanding is going to grow quickly. And I think the number of clinical trials shows you that there's buy-in because to get it out of the lab and into the clinic is a huge step. And we're seeing that. So I think we're on the pathway to seeing this kind of as a large, having a larger acceptance. But we're at the beginning.
That's interesting because, you know, the recipient could care less because they're suffering so much, right? And they're like, I have a friend now who's just like, I don't care. I don't care what it's from. I don't care how I have to ingest it. Just give it to me, you know? And it's so sad because they're just suffering so much. But I think we'll get past it. I think the society as a whole is going to understand it.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I wanted to briefly interrupt and remind you about Just Thrive spore-based probiotics, and I wanted you to listen to a quick clip of Kiran Krishnan, the celebrity microbiologist, talking about how important a diverse microbiome is and spore-based probiotics.
And the biggest issue with the allergies and all the crazy sensitivities, when you look at the prevalence rate of peanut allergies and environmental allergens, and the fact that asthma is now among kids is a pandemic, you know, all of these things are because of the loss of oral tolerance. The loss of oral tolerance means that what we used to be able to do is take in huge amounts of different, you know, proteins and antigens and things that people would now be allergic to. The immune system would be able to sample it. The bacteria within your gut would be there to help the immune system figure out, this is something you need to attack and this is something you need to leave alone. That's the process of immune tutoring. And that is lost when we lose the diversity in our microbiome.
Thanks for listening to Kiran Krishnan. If you want to use your coupon code HGG20 to get 20% off, just go to justthrivehealth.com and check out all the great things they have. And now back to the show.
I found this woman at the farmer's market. This is years ago. She was called the Bison Lady, and she had a bison farm, and she was selling bison, everything that a bison has, she was selling it. And she sold, we would get to talking, and I was telling her at the time I had three dogs, and she said, you should feed them paunch manure. I'm like, what is that? And she's like, it's the manure from, I forget which one of the stomachs. It's not the last stomach. It's like one of the middle, I don't know. And it's basically manure that is filled with microbes, and she sells it in these frozen bricks. And she's like, do not take it in your house because it stinks so bad. She's just open up your backyard and crack one open and throw it far away from your front, your door, and just leave it out there. And so I'm like, my dogs won't touch that. And she's like, just do it. So I bought, I think it was like a dollar for a huge brick. And I did it. All my dogs just went and just devoured it. And then, but they left a bunch of it. Like they, she's like, they know when to stop eating it. They just know. And I'm like, this is magic. How did she know that? And how, she's like, yeah, the dogs on the farm just eat the manure. And it's because it's, they just somehow know that it's filled with this microbe, you know, these microbes. It was tremendous. All my dog, well, two of our dogs live to be 16. They're big dogs too. And I would just feed them this paunch manure, but now they don't sell it. I can't find it anywhere. So, but that's like a type of FMT, isn't it?
Yeah. So, this is why that was like, oh, that's a really great. So FMT has been around for about 1700 years.
What?
So like we didn't decide yesterday that FMT is important, but it's coming into our understanding kind of since the early 2000s. It's really gotten kind of become more of like a thing that we know about or have heard about.
Okay.
But like it started in 4th century China. They called it yellow soup and it was given to people who had kind of excessive diarrhea. Mm. And then it pops up again around World War II, where soldiers were eating camel stool when they couldn't access antibiotics. And saw huge impacts in their gut health and, you know, kind of what an antibiotic would do is kind of the outcomes that they were seeing. And then we kind of see it kind of in general, you know, medical history kind of in the early 1950s, late 1950s. And that's kind of when the scientific trajectory of FMT kind of began, but it's been around for a really, really long time. And we've kind of, I think, appreciated that the bacteria in the gut could do positive things. Mm-hmm. But now the science is kind of catching up to that understanding.
Yeah.
But that's the part that's kind of always blown me away is that, you know, this isn't anything new. We're just trying to standardize it, make sure it has the right kind of checks and balances. And I think that's
safe.
Where we're at.
Yeah, that's the last thing you want is people going rogue. Yeah. It's so interesting. And, you know, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you've seen clinically in terms of these children with ASD and autism and what kind of, because I haven't heard of any of that. I'd love to know more.
Yeah. I guess I'll summarize the two major studies, and these two studies are kind of what spurred us as a company, based on parental kind of parents reached out and were like, okay, so like this, we need this. How do we do this? Right. Mm-hmm. So in 2017, Dr. James Adams' group from Arizona State did kind of the first groundbreaking work looking at FMT in children with ASD. And so they did 8 weeks of FMT. And that consists of two big loading doses, which is a larger amount. And these were both done through retention enemas. And that's to kind of get all the bacteria in there. So what we do before that, we as a company in the study as well, we prep the gut. So most of that's done through antibiotics. And that basically just wipes out the bacteria that is currently there. And then you put in a fair amount, a larger dose to try to give as much chance as engrafting as much of the bacteria as possible. Mm-hmm. And then for the remainder of those 8 weeks, they take oral capsules throughout that. And so this 2017 study showed that after 8 weeks of treatment, and then 8 weeks after that, so looking at a 16-week period, they saw a 77% improvement in GI symptoms and a 23% improvement in autistic behaviors. So in these cases, the first goal is GI symptoms. We know that they have huge impacts on quality of life for kids. And we know that they're prevalent in this population. These secondary outcomes are not what you're going for, but what you see. So all of these changes in autistic behaviors are, you know, in tied to or changed with kind of these GI symptom improvements. Mm. And they also looked and saw that GI symptoms, like their gut microbiome shifted to be more typical. So more to their typically developing pairs.
Wow.
So, and then, sorry, go ahead.
With the age range, because I know that a lot of times people like Donna Gates would say it's harder to like remediate the gut of an autistic child when they're already older, that it's much easier when they're younger. So what's the age range again with these children?
I do not know that off the top of my head anymore. I know it starts around 2, and none of them were like in their 20s, but there's a wider range for age because it's trying to find, in an experimental treatment at the beginning, finding the numbers and kids yeah. that kind of meet the requirements are kind of difficult. But okay. you are right. Like, it's a lot of targeting for these kind of things are done younger. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's necessary with FMT okay. because what you're doing is you're taking out the bacteria and putting new in, and it's going to re-educate the gut and you're going to see changes. Mm. Some of the changes may be more difficult because once you do FMT, well, now you have to feed the new gut. You have to make sure that what's in the environment is going to, you know, sustain that new gut. So that's, I think, where some of the harder parts of the changes come in, is that lifestyle change that goes with it.
Okay.
But I mean, FMT is used in adults as well. So I think it's just the awareness of like, okay, now that this is working, you have to keep feeding this gut. You keep having to do the things that make those changes.
Right.
But I think the astounding part with this group is that they looked 2 years later. So in 2019, they did a follow-up of the kids that were in the original study. Mm-hmm. And they looked at GI symptoms and AST behaviors again, and they actually found that the GI symptoms were maintained. So FMT was done for 8 weeks and that's it, never done again. And they looked 2 years after that and the GI symptoms were still improved. But the part that still gives me, you know, shivers is that AST symptoms continued to improve over those 2 years. So parents mm. reported this when they looked at it. Originally they saw a 23% improvement. After 2 years, they see a 47% improvement in ASD related behaviors. Mm-hmm. So that change in the gut that was maintained over those 2 years, well, we see continual improvements in symptoms. They also show, so with kids with ASD, they're kind of put into categories. So like, is it high, medium, or mild, moderate, mild, or, you know, under the cutoff.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
At the original part of this study, most of the children were considered severe. And after 2 years, most of them actually wouldn't have rated as being autistic.
Wow.
So these are huge changes. Yeah. This is the groundbreaking stuff that shows that it's really important. And some of this stuff came from really early work with kids with autism, showing that, you know, when they were, while they were taking antibiotics, they saw changes in their ASD related behaviors, but not when they weren't taking antibiotics. It was just while that was happening.
Interesting.
And so we're seeing more studies that are coming out. They're using shorter protocols and longer protocols. And so what we do as a company is we have extended, instead of doing 8 weeks, we do 16 weeks of treatment. And that's kind of a longer maintenance, those lower dosed oral capsules for a longer period of time. And that's kind of to ensure that the gut is completely engrafted. It's healthy. It gives time to make kind of those lifestyle changes as well, while the gut's still being supplemented with the FMT. And then we are also looking at, okay, so what changes in GI? What are the changes in autistic related behaviors so that we can gain more knowledge around this? These early studies are showing like it works, but now it's like, okay, so like what exactly are these changes? And that's where we're at now, is trying to understand exactly what is happening and why it's happening. Mm-hmm. But it seems to be pretty consistent across the board in the studies that have come out, that you do see changes in GI symptoms and ASD related behaviors. The amounts of those seem to depend on the protocols that are used. Mm-hmm. A study came out a couple of weeks ago that showed, not specific to kids with ASD, but just in general, people receiving FMT, if there was some prep done to the gut before they got FMT, and in this case, it was all antibiotic related, you were more likely to get better engraftment and better improvements than if you didn't do a pre-treatment.
Interesting.
So that's new. And I think we've kind of always known that you need to kind of, you know, give this new bacteria the best chance by putting a bacteria into an environment where there's already a kind of diverse, or even not a diverse, but a lot of bacteria already in there. Mm-hmm. You're asking it to try to integrate into an environment that already exists.
Right.
So by removing part of that and letting it kind of go, this new kind of healthier bacteria go into kind of there's less for it to compete with to kind of engraft, then we see higher engraftment, and then we see higher changes in what the gut microbiome looks like.
Wow. I mean, my brain is just going wild thinking about things like, I wonder, can it change like genetic components? You know, like if someone has the celiac genetic predisposition, like have they done any of that kind of study yet? Or have you seen?
I think it's you can have the genes for something, but never show it or never show it to the same severity, mm-hmm. Because a lot of these have environmental impacts in them. And I think that's the part that's changing. It's the stuff that can help perpetuate these underlying kind of behavioral changes or body kind of displays of the disease. So I think it's not changing it at a genetic level, but I think it's changing it or providing the body the blocks that it needs to become a healthier version of itself.
That is really cool, because that's, you know, it's kind of like replanting your garden. It's like you're going outside and you've got this aphid problem, or you've got this, you know, beetle problem, and then you just like uproot everything and you take everything out, and then you deposit like, you know, new soil, healthy soil and nutrients in there. And then you start to cultivate it again. And now you've got this beautiful garden, right? It's really the same kind of concept. That's really cool.
Yeah. And we see, so in children with ASD, some of the newer studies that have come out have looked at neurotransmitter biosynthesis pathways. And they're dysfunctional in children with ASD in the gut. And so what they see is after FMT, these pathways seem to be more functioning because we see changes in the serum levels of neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important to understand, is that the gut communicates really directly with the brain. It has huge impacts in the brain, ranging from kind of inflammatory responses to, you know, basic building blocks of how the brain communicates when we're thinking of neuromodulators and neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. And when they're dysfunctional in the gut, we're seeing dysfunction in the brain. But when you give those, you know, those building blocks, those abilities back to the gut, you see those kind of those systems come back online. And I think that's huge, because I think that's the thing we need to really understand when we're thinking about the gut and its widespread effects, because it's, even as someone who understands it, it almost still seems unbelievable.
Yeah.
That like, how are things like depression and anxiety, but as well as things like, you know, ASD, how are they tied to the gut? Like, how does that even make sense? But when you build it down to like the gut and the brain communicate back and forth, it's a bidirectional pathway, but it's in important things. The mind-blowing thing, I don't know how many times I've said that, but I've read, was like 90% of the serotonin is created in your gut. So of all of the serotonin created in your body, 90% of it is coming from the gut. Mm. But we know serotonin plays a huge role across the brain, not just in mood, but one of the ones that we think about when you hear the word serotonin, you think of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and you think of that as an antidepressant. Well, we know that that's important, but that so much is coming from the gut. It starts to make sense that like, okay, so like that's why these, what we consider brain diseases, could also be also gut diseases.
Yeah.
And I think that's the appreciation, so that I think as this research moves forward, that basic understanding has to be there so you can appreciate why these changes are happening.
Right.
Because it does somewhat feel unbelievable.
Yeah.
That changing GI symptoms in children with ASD changes, you know, how like, or reduces these autistic behaviors and allows them to kind of, you know, slowly start to match these neurotypical peers, but also just live a better life, have a better quality of life. And I mean, that's at the heart of what we're doing. It's how do we improve quality of life, both for the children and the families? Mm-hmm. And by improving GI symptoms, we know that that's going to happen. And then all of these secondary effects really do just improve quality of life for these kids.
Right.
And I think that's really important. And I think we're going to see that across more disorders as FMT kind of builds in popularity, I guess is the word I would use.
Yeah.
Because that's the change. When you talk to somebody who has really bad Crohn's or really bad IBS, it impacts their quality of life to a large amount. Yeah. Where they'll go, how long they'll go there, what foods they'll eat are all impacted. Things mm-hmm. that I think people take for granted.
Sure.
And I think by being able to improve those things and improve their ability to live their lives, you see other improvements because of that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the other important thing to think about, is like quality of life is really important as well. And I think this is one of those treatments that are going to, I think, will really improve quality of life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is incredible, you know, all the different possibilities. And you said, you know, the neurotransmitters and the gut, and GABA too, right? And I think melatonin and a bunch of different hormones in the gut. What about leaky gut? Does it fix? Because we know in autistic children that they have leaky gut across the board. So that the antibiotics and then the FMT must create some kind of electrical system that helps to heal the gut lining. Or what happens to leaky gut?
We don't know. And that's, I think, the hard part of moving a treatment that has a lot of positive impacts, but we don't know the mechanism of action. So we don't know why FMT works. Wow. We know that the bacteria and graft, we know we see changes in, you know, what the microbiota look like, and we see changes in, you know, behaviors, and we see changes in things like neurotransmitters, but we don't know what the mechanism of action of FMT is. We don't know why it works to the level that it does. We don't know what changes it makes, that it has such widespread improvements. So that's something we're still trying to understand. And I think that's why, as we move forward with how FMT can be done and our understanding of how we process it increases, mm-hmm. I think we'll start understanding more and more the mechanism of action. But we're kind of at the point where we know it works, but we don't know why.
Yeah, it's cool. It's magic. I'm good with that. That's amazing. This is such good news. And I was not expecting to hear that such incredible improvement with their behavior and stuff. Were there some children who were nonverbal that became verbal?
We've seen shifts in children that we've worked with. Mm-hmm. You don't get, unfortunately, everything has to be done through kind of standardized methods of kind of evaluation. So those would take into account those. But when you look at the number kind of shifts, it's not specific to like these five behaviors came back. Mm-hmm. But we do see kids that were nonverbal beginning to kind of use those, begin to kind of grow their verbal acumen. Mm-hmm. But as well as is aggressive behaviors are changed. Mm. And so the number of behaviors we're seeing shifted kind of tie into the shift of behaviors when GI symptoms seem to flare in these children as well. So it's kind of widespread. It seems to be child by child, depending on, you know, what kind of impacts we see, but they're quite astounding. Wow. I think it almost feels sometimes too good to be true. Because it is these, and you talk to these parents, and we have a couple of interviews with parents on our YouTube channel, which is just like, so you can just hear from a parent, like what did it look like for you? And what kind of changes did you see? And so I think that's for me, like hearing it coming from someone who's done it, mm-hmm. and seen the changes and kind of lived those, I think is incredible. Makes a huge difference.
Yeah. So do people, do just the average person can have access to this? Like, do you go to a clinic like the Taymount type of thing, or is this still all studies, or how would that work? Because we have a pretty large demographic in my husband's practice of children, and I'm sure they're going to want to know, like, can they, you know, access this?
Yeah. So none of the treatments we provide are available to Canadians across the board. That's with working with Health Canada. So we don't provide any treatment to any Canadians. But if you're anywhere else in the world, you can reach out to us through our website. And what's on our website is you can't book treatment on our website. You can book a call to talk to someone on our team.
Okay.
And we walk you through what is it, what is the process? You know, what's your life look like? Okay, is this actually a fit for you? Because it may not be for everybody, or the expectations may not fit what we know right now. But as well as this is something we want people to be informed about. Mm-hmm. You need to completely understand everything that's going to happen and why. Mm-hmm. And so that's our approach to it is, you know, go read what's on the website, understand it, then book a call to talk with us so we can answer your questions. We can ask you the right questions so you can kind of understand, is this the right fit? And I think that from our perspective is the only way to do it, because there is a lot of, there's too much to read, but none of those things I think are easily accessible to really understand. And that's a big part of what we're doing is trying to educate. We make educational videos, we write educational blogs, we make educational posts on social media, because outside of what we do as a company, we want people to understand what this treatment is and what it can do, what gut health is and why it's important. Mm-hmm. Because I think that those are the building blocks for, overall health is understanding what your gut can do and how you can impact it. Mm-hmm. And then that this treatment exists, I think is kind of our general goal, is just to educate about it, because there isn't a lot known about it, but it's, I think, something everyone should understand.
Yeah.
So that they can appreciate, you know, what's capable, and what they're capable of doing for their gut health to kind of make a change today. That could be, you know, huge.
And I think also, like you had said earlier, just like getting it, it's like it needs to start, get this momentum to start making its way around the world, you know, around the planet as an option, and just so people start hearing about it, right? Because that's how we bring it into awareness, is just keep talking about it.
Really, we want to provide education. The person who owns the company, Dr. Klopp, is a huge fan of podcasts, and I'm on the same boat of like, this is so much information. It's too much for people to try and find out for themselves. Okay, what's the best that we can go about it to provide this information to a large population in succinct format? And so we're trying to kind of lean into like, how do we find the right people who know how to ask the right questions that have the audience that could appreciate that this exists? And so, and I think it's growing, and I think as it grows, it will get better because I think it'll become more consistent. And I think as it becomes more consistent, access goes up. But we're at that point where it's like the research is like mind blowing, and then it goes, okay, so like, but why can't everybody get this today?
Right.
And so I mean, that's why
funny like that.
Yeah. I mean, that's why we exist. We have 4 clinics across the world, and people can go to them. But that, and you know, but that's where we're at right now, is like, okay, so you have to go somewhere, get this. It's not easily accessible yet, but we know that it works. And I think we're on the pathway. There's a big pharma company that's doing the work in ASD, doing the clinical trials. And I think if they get FDA approval, then smaller companies can also buy into that. But it's just,
that's what they're waiting on, right?
Yeah.
Do you know microbiome labs? No, what is it? Animal biome labs?
And then there's Open Biome, or the big.
I think it was Animal Biome something. They do capsules, like you send your dogs pooping, and then they make these capsules like FMTs for dogs. Did you know that?
Yeah, there's a big, I mean, we talk with vets fairly regularly as well, because there is a need for it in animals as well. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the case. Like naturally based things seem to be like just as popular in veterinary or they are an animal or humans. So I find that pretty astounding, but it makes huge changes in animals as well. So it's.
Wow. I mean, I had the woman on my show a while back, and it was, I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow. Yeah. You just send your dogs pooping, and then then they just make those like supplements for them. It's so fascinating.
We have a biome storage. So we do like AFMT storage. So like AFMT is autologous. So it's like your own microbiome. So we do storage of that for people that like, when you're in a healthy state and you want to store it in case you have to take antibiotics and your gut doesn't come back, or as we're learning more and more about aging and how that might play, their gut microbiome may play a role in it. So storing it when you're young and healthy, so it's ready if you need it as you age. And as like we get more buy-in from that, I think there'll be more use for that as well. But that's a whole other side of everything. But we're appreciating how important it is to have your microbiome ready and stored. And we have the capabilities of storing it long-term in formats that we do. So that's kind of our other prong is like, okay, so like, and we're looking at it originally, it started with like, okay, so like parents and families, right now your gut microbiomes are at their best. But if your child has to take antibiotics again, what could happen? So, you know, that's kind of where the idea started, which was like, could we store, you know, the gut microbiome from these kids when it's healthy, it's working, it's doing what we need it to. Could we store it? And then if they had to take antibiotics, because kids get sick, they get ear infections, they get strep throat, they have to take antibiotics, then they could then get their own gut microbiome back that we know works for them. So, and that's kind of grown from, you know, providing that treatment, that accessibility to anybody that wants to do it. Like, are you healthy today and want to keep it? So if you had to take antibiotics and you get C. diff, or you're, you know, you have GI issues after having antibiotics, or GI issues develop as you age. Okay, so you have this ready to go back to, you know, your younger version,
yeah,
which was healthy and doing what it needed to.
That is really cool. I'm going to have to put this in there. That is really interesting. So when you take the antibiotics to prep the gut, so you're wiping out like all the colonies, all the bacteria that live in that person's body, in that person's gut.
Yeah, as much as possible. So it's not going to be 100%. But what it does is we talk about the importance of high diversity. Well, in this case, we're looking for really low diversity, because what we want is, when we put a highly diverse, healthy gut in there, we want it to be able to engraft. We don't want you to think about it. If you could only have 100 things in there, and there's 100 things already there, you know, the competition to find one spot goes up. Okay. But if you only have 10 there and you have 100 spots, okay, so when we put the new ones in, they can become the predominant bacteria and the predominant gut microbiota. Uh-huh. And so then they get to engraft, and then they can teach what is there and the gut itself. Okay, so like, this is what your gut microbiome should look like. This is what we should be processing. This is what we should be extracting. And then that kind of, you know, slowly rolls into a better functioning gut, because you have the right bacteria there, and it's going to teach, how what should we be taking out of this food? How should we be storing these fats? You know, what should we be making? That's what those bacteria are going to do. And so then, you have an engrafted new community, and it's able to do that because the competition between what was there and what we're putting in is reduced.
Cool. That's really cool. It's that competitive aspect to our microbiomes, isn't it? There's always this, like, what does Kiran Krishnan call it? It's like competitive inhibition or something like that, or competitive, where they're always kind of like jockeying for control. I guess that's just nature, isn't it?
Yeah. What's predominant? I saw a YouTube video. I love watching animated versions of this, mostly because it gives me like a visual of how to explain it better. But it was the idea that, like, if you have like pizza bacteria and like kale bacteria, and you eat lots and lots of pizza, then you make more pizza bacteria, but that kills off the kale bacteria. And while that's not what's actually happening, it's a good visual of like the food that you choose feeds specific bacteria, which then helps you crave that more. And you want it more because that's what that bacteria wants to eat. But then you kill off the other ones because they're not being fed. And so, like, that was a good visual for me to, like, okay, that's a good way to explain this, because it's hard to put into a simplified version, because it's not a simplified concept. But really, when you break it down to, there are bacteria in your gut, and you have to feed each one of them. And if you only eat a handful of foods, you're only feeding a handful of bacteria. And it's not that you won't have, you know, as much, but what ends up happening is you have a bunch of one kind. And so then your gut is less diverse, but it can do less because it is less diverse.
Well, I mean, that explains picky eaters, doesn't it? And especially children who are, you know, not even just autistic children or in the spectrum, but children who just have this really, you know, limited microbiome, and their diet choices, you know, their menu is like three things, you know, and that's usually why, isn't it? So I would always say to people, when they're making, you know, fermented veggies and cultured foods, is, you know, when you're craving sugar, or you're craving, I don't say just sugar, because sugar is important, but if you're craving, you know, processed foods and candies and cereals and gluten, you know, things like that, breads and pastries, like those things, are obviously, like you said, like the pizza bacteria, but fermented foods are quite sour, and it's hard to have the palate for sour if you're always eating those simple carbs or those simple sugary things. And so, you know, it's like when you're introducing yourself to, or introducing cultured foods into your diet, they always say, take little bits at a time, and even just the juice of like the vegetables, and slowly do it, because it's kind of like you're introducing these new bacteria, and you're not going to like it at first. That sour palate for like a child who's got really picky diet is just like the worst. But you slowly do it, and it starts to kill those sugar cravings and kill those desires for those bad foods. It takes time. And now we know why, with all of what you've explained. all that population has to start to fight and switch and become diverse, right?
And it's, and food plays such a huge impact. We're starting to understand more. A study just came out the other day about the impacts of exercise and how that shifts the gut microbiome and its time course. But the work on diet has been done for a while, which is like diverse, healthy diets. Well, they shift your gut microbiome, like, you know, as it's happening, you know, within 24 hours, you see a shift and you continue to do that. And that shift becomes more dominant, but it's a huge driving force. And that's something we, those are the two, there's two things we tell everybody when they ask about the gut microbiome. Look at your environment, look what's in there, look, you know, are there moles, are there toxins, are there heavy metals? Look at that. That's something you can make a change in. And the other is diet, because those are tangible, accessible things that you can make a change for. And as your gut gets healthier, you can make more changes and you'll be driven to make different changes. But those are two things that we know make huge impacts quickly, but they're tangible things. Yeah. It's really easy to tell people be less stressed,
right?
Sleep better. But you can't always do that, or you don't have the tools, or you're not in a healthier mindset or state to do those changes. But okay, like, let's look at your diet. Try your best to work your way up to eating 50 different things a week and work your way towards being able to do that. But as you work towards that, you're shifting your gut microbiome every day. And with that, things like your mood will also shift because those are tied together. And so, you know, those are the important things, I think, as a message for like, but what do I do? Because FMT is not for everybody. FMT is not for everybody because your gut is not at a point where it needs it. So if you're not in a state of gut dysbiosis, but your gut isn't as healthy as you would like to be, what do you do? And I think that's a big part of it, is like, what can you actively do? And because of those active actions, other things will shift. Because we see ties to sleep and gut microbiota, you know, and sleep is huge for literally everything. But you can't tell someone will sleep better.
Right. So you definitely can't just tell someone that.
I tell myself that every day. Here we are.
That was such a nice surprise for me. I knew she was going to be good and I knew that this information would be interesting, but I had no idea how far the science had come with the FMTs. Because for those of you who remember my episode with the woman who had C. diff on my show, like, gosh, I think her name was Carrie. I think I have to look back. I feel bad that I don't remember. Anyway, you know, she had this really advanced condition of C. diff and she was suffering greatly. She literally almost died a couple of times from this digestive issue. And she went to England to have this FMT done a couple of times. Maybe more than a couple. And and as far as I know, she's still thriving and doing really well. So it's just information, I think, that it would behoove us to become familiar with it. I mean, you don't have to become an expert by any means, but because we all know somebody that has severe gut issues. It might even be ourselves, but everything from Crohn's to diverticulitis to IBS to C. diff to UC, all of it, IBD, even food sensitivities, all the leaky gut stuff. We all know someone who is greatly suffering. And we also, these days, all of us know someone who is autistic, right? Or who has ASD. I mean, that's something to say, because, you know, when I was in high school, I didn't know anybody in the spectrum. Of course, I was probably in the spectrum. I mean, I'm not laughing. I'm pretty sure I was. But, you know, we just didn't have that. We weren't that familiar with what the characteristics of someone in the spectrum were so much. And there weren't as many children And now we know adults, we know children, we all know somebody. So this information is really important for you to share with others and also to just familiarize yourself with it, because I think it's useful. It's useful to know about a diverse microbiome and how we can facilitate that and all of that good info, friends. I did want to be specific about the probiotics that Kiran Krishnan created. He developed two different companies, Megaspore and Just Thrive. I believe that Just Thrive is minus one strain that is in Megaspore, but otherwise they're identical. And I have heard that they're quite the same in terms of how they feel with, you know, whoever uses them, including myself, who have used both and who has used both. And the Just Thrive. So the difference with these probiotics is they are spore-based, and Kiran talks a lot about these particular strains and how they are useful in the gut, how they don't cure everything, but they are helpful to start to help to remediate the imbalances that we have at the gut. I'm so fascinated. We should probably have Kiran back, because I think a lot has changed since the last couple of times I've had him on, just to talk about that stuff. Particularly interested in endotoxin and the mucosal lining and leaky gut. So yeah, don't forget to use your coupon code if you'd like to order the prebiotic and spore-based probiotic bundle from Just Thrive. And that code is HGG20. So that right there makes it cheaper than Megaspore by a long shot. And once again, if you want to reach out to Dr. Shana, and you just have to look in the show notes, remember this treatment is not available to Canadians. You can find her company information all right there in the show notes. I believe it's novelbiome.com. They have an Instagram, YouTube channel. All of it is in the show notes. And this episode will also be up on their YouTube channel and on mine. By the way, friends, my YouTube channel is finally becoming more robust. It was very sparse in the past, and I apologize for that. But my YouTube channel is Healthy Gut Girl, HGGTV. Is the name of my YouTube channel, Healthy Gut Girl HGGTV. You can also look it up by looking for Kitty Martone. And I'm starting to just post all of the episodes that I have been Zoom recording since the beginning of Zoom that I never shared on YouTube. I only shared the audio onto my podcast. Meanwhile, I have all these wonderful people who I've had on, and I have their beautiful faces and my funny face mixed together on a Zoom call in an episode just like this one today. And you can see it all and watch us in action. So go to my YouTube channel when you get a chance. And thanks for joining us.